Our next guest on the show is none other than the creator of Son of Szalka, Son of God, Dan Warren. Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
It is a pleasure. And I guess you've probably been asked this question a lot, but what gave you the idea for this project?
Well, it really just came from, I've done sort of sampling-based music, particularly based on, you know, spoken word and stuff like that before. But in this case, it really kind of came to me while I was listening to his autobiography, that the way he speaks is particularly at minimals being taken apart and reassembled. So he just tends to speak in these very discrete sub-clauses that are sort of natural pauses in the text. And that makes it really easy to kind of dissect and reassemble.
Yeah, it's amazing how natural the sentences flow. Did you have to do anything to make the intonation work in terms of these new sentences, or is that really the way that he speaks?
For the most part, I didn't actually do too much manipulation within a single clause or manipulating the intonation of the voice. A lot of the reason that flows as well as it does is because I have a lot of redundancy in some of those phrases. So there are certain sub-clauses that tend to pop up really often in everybody's speech, but particularly in his writing. And so that makes it easy to say, you know, for instance, you know, the word suddenly appears, you know, probably dozens of times in his autobiography, and that makes it really easy to find a suddenly that is appropriate to a particular point in the story.
I see. Like, suddenly, or suddenly.
Exactly.
So what was your process like? I mean, how did you organize this word palette? Did you feed it in and then work from a very oral audio perspective, or did you use some kind of software to analyze the words so you could see them all written on paper? I'm just fascinated. How did you do this?
It started off with literally like a year and a half of just good, massively boring grunt work, which was, and when I say a year and a half, this is something I would work on, you know, I do 30 minutes a night, you know, for a year and a half. It's not something this was not my day job. I went through the whole book, or audio book, looking for little sub clauses that I thought could be kind of pulled out. And then basically I would create a separate sound clip for each one of those that had as its name the actual text that was in that clip, right? So I could look at a directory and see a file for each one of these little clips. And then it's just sort of like assembling the kind of magnetic poetry where you have the different little words and things like that,
right,
on your refrigerator, where you can sort of mix and match. I use a program called Acid, and in Acid, basically, you can just sort of drag through and assemble it like a magnetic poem. And there's some editing after that point to make it sound more natural and make the pauses sound natural and things like that. But that's the main process. It really is like that magnetic poetry.
Where did you start to pick up the thread of the story?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Actually, I think the first thing where I said, okay, I have to do something with this. So initially, I wasn't really aware that it was going to be a single coherent narrative. I heard a few little bits where I'm like, oh, my goodness, I can do something with this. And they seem to be, you know, separate little bits. The chapter where the apocalypse happens, so chapter 5, the fall, that one, I was hearing these little bits, was it the world split open or something like that? I'm like, oh, my goodness. And there were all these other little bits. I started to say, man, that sounds like a really ominous apocalyptic story. And then also, I think the other part that came up really early on was with him talking to the turtle that floats in space. And, you know, he said those words. I'm like, okay, at some point, I've got to be talking to this turtle. And from there, it just sort of expanded outwards. And it actually really sort of started in the middle of the story and expanded back to the beginning of the world and into the final chapter where he's reintroduced to his mother.
And his father.
His father, yeah, who he'd never actually met, I suppose.
Well, speaking of apocalyptic stories, I mean, I was obviously trying to draw parallels as I was listening, and biblical parallels seem all over the place, and New Testament is obviously an apocalyptic story.
Right.
It struck me when he was speaking with the turtle that there's kind of a Job quality there. He's asking some very similar questions. Why do good people suffer? You know, why do the righteous suffer? Why does pain exist?
Right.
Did
and
you...
the answer he gets is so unsatisfying, because the answer is basically, Well, it was fun.
Okay, the answer I had written down, which you're obviously way more familiar, I thought the answer was kind of plausible in a way. It was to obliterate the past.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. So it seemed like, I mean, to me, what the turtle is saying there, and I'm totally open to the possibility that there are different interpretations of this. This whole thing is basically the result of sort of my own kind of personal Rorschach test with the little bits of this story. But, I mean, what I sort of heard in that was kind of him saying, you know, that he just, the turtle is sort of like had this love of wrecking things and of obliterating the past. I mean, in a sense, it was this kind of idea that the purpose in a grander sense was kind of to cleanse the world of all that had gone before it, particularly, you know, a couple of chapters where the world is clearly kind of in decline. And so there's that element to it. But you can also just hear in the way the turtle speaks that he really kind of enjoyed it. Just for its own sake. With a bit about the astronauts, at the end there, I feel like there's this kind of thing about, you know, mankind's hubris, and that whole Tower of Babel angle.
Right. I wonder, do these, you know, you mentioned it's your own personal Rorschach test. Do these answers mean anything to you, or is this kind of an absurdist mad lib of, you know, of audio?
Well, you know, it's funny. I always have been, and you know, I didn't actually realize this about myself until I started putting this story out there and talking to people about it. I really have always been drawn really to apocalyptic stories. So, in a sense, maybe it's not too surprising that that's what came out of it. But I mean, I think also that's a cultural thing. If you just sort of look at the summer blockbusters, there's pretty much one or two every summer where a large chunk of the world is destroyed. So,
right. it certainly figures large in not just the Western imagination, but, you know, Mayans and many cultures had actual apocalypses of their civilizations or apocalypse myths. There's some unexpected moments. I think there's a good balance between kind of humor and absurdity, but there's lots of kind of one of these is not like the others moments when you and it starts to sound kind of even like something Obama might say. This is the myth of America. This is, I'm thinking of an earlier, I think it's the Son of Strelka or maybe the Golden Age, and it's a matinee movie and then a gray clip-on tie that just to me, you know, really stands out, and it keeps the listener snapping to attention as soon as you start to kind of get lulled into another one. Is at the end, and since everyone's listened to it, you know, it's not a spoiler, but and then a hole where his nose would be, and that's
right,
the father.
Yeah.
And it's like that is sort of a horror.
Yeah, so that one actually it sort of surprised me when I did it. I was trying to figure out, you know, I thought his father should away and kind of crumble away. I kind of have this Yoda thing going on in my head where he just sort of the father just sort of disintegrates, I suppose. But how do I convey that? And then the answer that I thought, I mean, I thought worked well was just how it happened suddenly and rather shockingly, kind of in mid sentence like that. Yeah, and I liked that approach. I felt like it might be a little too jarring, but ultimately I decided to keep it, and I think it works well. Oh wait, his father's falling apart.
Right. No, it was a beautiful moment of audio theater. You know, it's like the kind of thing that's really hard to accomplish elsewhere. Where the pictures, and, you know, in this case, we're just listening to it, not looking at all the animation, really works.
Right.
As far as myths that you were drawing from or source material, I don't know, besides obviously Dreams of My Father, was Star Wars something? Did you research Joseph Campbell? Or did you just play? You just went straight into, you know, the unconscious?
Well, I'm familiar with, you know, just in this, like, secondhand sense with Joseph Campbell and kind of what he said about the hero's arc and all that sort of stuff. And I was thinking about that kind of later on in the process. When it became clear that there was going to be this whole arc, at the very least from the beginning of the world to the end of the world and its reconstruction, I started to think about that kind of thing. And in a sense, once again, I only know Campbell secondhand just from other people talking about it. But in a sense, I think it does follow that kind of archetypal heroic arc, except that he, basically his first memory is kind of the loss of the mentor, which I think is supposed to come normally later in the story. So
when he realizes that he's just a big yellow dog, the baleful howl.
Right. Exactly. And when you know, so he's essentially born without a father, and his mother and he separate, you know, minutes after his very first memory. So he kind of grows up alone without a whole lot of supervision or a whole lot of instruction. So that I guess that mentor character that I guess is in the archetypal Campbell-esque hero story is a little absent, or at mm-hmm. least not there for long.
But the slaying of the father at the end, not slaying, but, you know, the disappearance. And I mean, I love the A, it does satisfy that archetype.
It does, yes.
And then the kind of just loony celebratory moment that happened.
Yeah, he's
like, now I can do whatever I want, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And I love that there's still that kind of ambiguity. And this is something, so that very last chapter is actually, it's my favorite chapter of the thing, and it's something that I didn't even know was going to happen until pretty much near the very end. When I started kind of laying it out, and I'm like, oh, wait, we actually really kind of need this. The whole arc of what the world does through the story, which basically ends at the end of chapter 8, I saw there was the material there to do like the sort of end of his personal arc, which is, you know, which is what chapter 9 is. And that one, I was just, it was something I initially didn't plan on, and I feel like it really kind of brings the whole thing together. I was just really happy when I got all that stuff together and heard that it worked, you know. But I love that there's that ambiguity still at the end where his mother is convinced that he's still living out some sort of cosmic plan, and he thinks he's finally free. And I don't know which one of those is true, actually.
Was there ever a moment when you were hunting for a word, like you really needed to find a specific word? I'm sure there were many moments like that, and you just couldn't find it.
Yeah, and there are a few spots in there where I had to do sort of editing within the middle of a phrase. I refrained from doing that as much as possible. But there are areas where, like, he said just almost the right thing, and I had to do everything I could to sort of make it sound like it was the right thing. So, for instance, when he's talking to the Buddha, and the Buddha says, it's just the end of the world, the words that are actually in Obama's autobiography are, it's not the end of the world. And so I had to bring that just in from elsewhere and try to make it sound natural. And there are a few other areas like that where I really had to do some very fine-scale editing. But I resisted it as much as possible, both out of sort of, I guess, this weird kind of oblique purism, but also just out of laziness, because that's a pain in the ass to do well.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I imagine it must have been this relationship between collage and there's a certain receptiveness that you show, and you know what I mean, in creating something in that way through purely
exactly.
through sampling. But then at some point, you know, the structure begins to emerge and you're actively kind of imposing what you want onto the piece of art too, or trying
exactly.
to actively form the structure.
Right. And that's, that's exactly how it felt. Like, I felt like, you know, the original idea here was actually kind of a very structured audio collage. And in a sense, there were a few little points where I kind of had to take a step back from the sort of methodological conceptual outline of it in pursuit of getting the story right. So, and I think that's a worthwhile trade-off to make. I mean, I think, you know, there might be somewhere out there someone who has just lost interest because I'm no longer a true purist. But I think the pursuit of something that actually sort of does what I wanted it to do is to me worth making a couple of small compromises.
And what did you want it to do exactly?
Oh, I mean, just tell the story in a way that was as, you know, clear and understandable as possible. And that's one of the things about this is, you know, I had worked on this for off and on for 4 years. And though I had this very clear and complicated kind of mythology in my head or story in my head about how this is going on. And when you know the basic outlines of the story, as I did, you know, I think clear made 12 chapters, but it wasn't clear to me necessarily that any other person who didn't know all that would come to this and actually be able to understand what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was essentially making those sacrifices, it was in pursuit of telling the story as clearly as possible. And I still, like I say, I've been too close to it for too long. I'm still not sure exactly how well it works or when it fails to work, if it does.
What did you think was going to happen when you finished this project and released it? And has the reality in any way reflected your expectations?
I thought a half dozen people would go, well, that's pretty neat. And a whole bunch of people would go, what the heck is that? And actually, I've been really, really pleasantly surprised with how many people have you know, taken to it and enjoyed it. Because it's, I mean, I think coming from liking this sort of stuff that I like in general, it's not that odd. I've had people respond really positively to it that I would never expect to respond to something that was so kind of abstract and weird. And so that's been, I think, a very pleasant surprise for me. I'm happy to be weird, but this is not something I did in the pursuit of being odd or anything like that. It's something I did because I thought it would be cool, and I'm glad that other people agree.
And we're pretty deep into the interview to mention this, but you are, as far as I understand, an evolutionary ecologist.
I am.
So how has this affected your cover was blown. If you were sort of moonlighting as an audio editor, I mean, clearly, you know, the guys at work or in the lab, right, or wherever know what you're up to when you go home. How has this changed your life? And how do you think, I have some ideas about how it may have affected the story, but how do you think your perspective as a scientist has played into the story?
Well, in answer to the first part of that, you know, not much. I mean, I think I've been doing, I was a musician for a long time before I was a scientist, and I've never really stopped that. So I've been releasing, not albums this, not like a, but more sort of standard, I guess, singer-songwriter sort of albums for as long as I've been a scientist. So I don't think it's a shock to anybody. As far as how being a scientist has affected this process, that's kind of interesting. I haven't really thought about it, to be honest. I mean, I think, in a sense, it may manifest itself in, like I said, there was that sort of desire to communicate the story I had in mind clearly, as opposed to, I suppose, being more abstract. And maybe that's at least the same kind of temperament. I'm into some, you know, fairly odd music and stuff like that. And I often wonder whether the artist actually had a meaning in mind when they were doing something abstract, or whether they just do something abstract entirely for the abstractness of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whether there's a meaning here that I'm struggling to perceive, or whether there's a meaning that, or whether I'm imposing meaning on something that was just made to be pretty. And I don't do the latter part of that very well in my own music. I'm very much putting what I mean to say into my stuff, and I think maybe that's part of that that same temperament as being a scientist, is to try to, you know, communicate something very clearly and succinctly.
And is part of the message something of disillusionment or of, there's lots of species. I mean, there were animals, there's monkeys, and, you know, all kinds of things,
right,
kind of alive,
yeah,
and afoot. But there is a dystopic vision at times. And is that part of what you have,
sure,
to say, or is it not a political statement at all?
Well, you know, it's funny. So it was initially intended just to be a good story, but I definitely started thinking about the kind of political angles of it as the process was going on. And I think there is somewhat of a political or a cultural kind of miasma that's settled over America in the past decade or so, mm-hmm, where there is a sort of feeling like perhaps our best days are behind us. I certainly hope that's not true. But it seems like a fairly common sentiment. And so that definitely went in there, that sort of feeling. And also, I mean, I think, in a sense, if you look at what a lot of us expected from Obama, there was kind of this idea that he was going to be the end to that, that there was going to be a return to a government that we could be proud of as opposed to just tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people differ on how much they think that that happened or not, but I think the sense that there was a fundamental change, a restructuring of who we were as a nation in his election, I think that is, for good or ill, I think a lot of people felt that way. I mean, a lot of people, you know, even on the right, felt like this was the end of the world. And a lot of people, I think, on the left felt like it was the beginning of a new world. And
right,
I think we were all wrong. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we expected utopia and we wanted it,
yeah,
now, you know. You
exactly
can't wait for things to change. That's
right,
boring.
Right.
That's
but, yeah, I mean, I think, yeah. So in a sense, I started to think of it more and more, especially as the process went on, as kind of a commentary on Obama's personal journey as someone who had all this expectation put on him. So, yeah, you know, it was initially intended to be just a big story, but or a cool story, but more and more the kind of the political and, I suppose, sociological angle of our expectations of Obama factored into it.
Sure. And speaking of which, did you get any calls from the White House?
No, but I would love to.
Still waiting?
Yeah, still waiting. one of the things that I really thought about, this is sort of related to that, but that I really thought about during this process, because this is the first time, like I say, I've done a lot of stuff with sampling a spoken word and stuff before, but this is the first time I've ever done anything that was this linear and this story-driven and all that. And one of the things that really kind of, from an artistic perspective, I started thinking about, which I'd never considered before, was who was actually telling this story.
Mm-hmm.
And the original came from particular phrases and words he used and the way he spoke and all that. And even, you know, when I was really deep into the story, when I knew what I wanted to be said, what could be all relied on his autobiography and how he chose to say that. And so it's really kind of collaborative at moments there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I think we're starting to lose our connection here, so I'm going to wrap it up. But was there anything you wanted to add? Any future projects you'd like to discuss before we let you go?
Well, one thing I want to make sure that people know is that the album is not for sale. You can download it for free. So if you go to sonofstrelka.com, that'll redirect you to my blog where you can get the whole thing for free.
Mm-hmm.
We are still looking for animators to do other chapters of it. Anyone out there is interested in that, I'd love to hear from them. And as for future projects, I'm looking now. It's hard to find people who have just that quality of speech that really works for this.
I can imagine, yeah.
But I'm looking right now at astronaut memoirs. So,
speaking of astronauts, I'm assuming that by Strelka you mean Russian space dog? Am I right?
Yes.
Door number three.
Yeah. It's not literally supposed to be that Strelka. But that's why I chose her name. Yeah. It's because it's mentioned that he was potentially a victim of radiation poisoning, and he had the head of a dog and all that. And so it seemed like, thinking about radioactive dogs, you got to be thinking about Belka and Strelka and Laika.
Well, again, my guest has been Dan Warren. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.